Every time I do a sermon on particular love rather than universal love, it is almost impossible to find hymns that work with the sermon. By particular love, I mean the love that is between actual people. By universal love, I mean that kind of abstract meta-category of love, capital L. Universal love encompasses every conceivable manifestation of love in the universe. In choosing hymns about particular love, we always seem to come back to Ryan Wren's hymn that we started the service with, Love Makes a Bridge, because it actually is, at least partly, about particular love. Now, I used to think that talking about universal love was more difficult than talking about particular love. I've changed my tune. Maybe it's 25 years of marriage. I actually think talking about universal love, which is what we mostly do in religious institutions, hence the hymns that only seem to be about this universal love. Talking about universal love is a dodge and a cop-out. This is not to say that universal love does not exist. I believe it does, but I think we only experience it in particular love. The only way we experience love is with the little L. Love with a partner, with a child, with a parent, a friend, a coworker, a neighbor, and if we've really exercised our compassion muscle enough, maybe even with a stranger. Wendell Berry uses an analogy to make sense of this, and he writes, "One cannot enact or fulfill one's love for womankind or mankind, or even for all the women and or men to whom we are attracted, if one is to have the power and the delight of one's sexuality, then the generality of instinct must be resolved in a responsible relationship to a particular person. Similarly, one cannot live in the world. That is, one cannot become, in the easy, generalizing sense with which the phrase is commonly used, a world citizen. There can be no such thing as a global village. No matter how much we may love the world as a whole, we can only live fully in it by living responsibly in some small part of it. Where we live and who we live there with define the terms of our relationship to the world and to humanity. We thus come again to the paradox that one can become whole only by the responsible acceptance of one's partiality. One can become whole only by the responsible acceptance of one's partiality. Wise words, Wendell. None of us can literally and actively love every single human being on this planet. We experience universal love by engaging in love with particular people, just as we experience the world by living as fully as we possibly can in one small part of it. Devotion to love, capital L, and world, capital W, happen in the real, partial, imperfect relationships and places we embody. Devotion to love and world embodied in our actual relationship and in the places we actually live, this is the journey toward wholeness. So staying in a loving relationship with a life partner year after year, decade after decade, is no easy feat. Emerson notes that it requireth courage stout. Man, that dude must have been married, huh? Wendell Berry writes a beautiful essay comparing poetry and marriage. Both, he suggests, have the limitations of form, but paradoxically, because of these very constraints, great possibilities open up. I like that thought. Wendell Berry also writes that two muses work in both poetry and in marriage, the muse of inspiration and the muse of realization. The muse of inspiration gives us inarticulate visions and desires. The muse of realization, he writes, returns again and again to say, it is yet more difficult than you thought. He goes on to say that to only hear the muse of inspiration is to live the bitterness of disappointment. So when I'm doing a marriage ceremony, and it's all set up to be the fairy princess wedding kind of thing, I worry. I worry that they are actually sowing the bitter seeds of disappointment. The muse of realization needs to visit, and she needs to visit soon. Okay, so how is marriage not easy? Let me count the ways. No, there's too many of them. I'll just count one. Here's the one. The constant evolution of every human being. I think that is so, so difficult. Just as the vast majority of our cells die over time, so that in some profound physical sense we are not at all the same person we were 15 years ago, just like that, everything about us and our circumstances change over time. Sure, there's some continuity in each human being through the course of a lifetime, but there is so much change. The ancient Greek philosopher Heraclitus observed that you can't step into the same river twice. This is true not only because the river flows by and it's different the next time you step in, but actually your foot is different too. If I go back to a river I stepped foot in 15 years ago, virtually every cell in my foot will be gone from that stepping in 15 years earlier. So when we speak our marriage vows, we promise to stay together in spite of not knowing how we'll change, how our partner will change, or what circumstances we will encounter. We don't even know if this death that will do us part might happen tomorrow or in 70 years. Talk about a leap of faith into the unknown. Wendell Berry again. In joining ourselves to another, we join ourselves to the unknown. You do not know the road, rather, you have committed your life to a way. And here I need to say very clearly that not all marriages should go on till death do them part. Some marriages are wastelands of no hope, with no hope of improvement. Some are downright evil, where abuse takes place. If the way you have committed to is a way that might kill you, then get out of it if it's safe to do so. Sometimes divorce is the very best outcome. Sometimes it's a life-saving outcome. In my view, any religion that labels every divorce a sin is allying itself with perpetrators of abuse. And while I'm clarifying my message today, let me also say that I'm using marriage and life partnership interchangeably. I trust that you know by marriage, I never mean just those relationships blessed by the state. By marriage, I mean any intentional lifetime commitment between two people. Such commitments may have the blessing of the state, they may have the blessing of a religious community, they may have both, or neither. Okay, so marriage is hard. Sometimes marriage needs to end. So why marry at all? Because marriage also contains a huge possibility of abundant goodness, not perfection, but abundant goodness. Just like the form that restricts poetry can create poems that sing beautiful songs. A good marriage can help us flower as individuals. It gives us somebody to dance with in joy and to cry with in sorrow, making the dance that much sweeter and the crying that much more manageable. In its peak moments, marriage can give us amazing, beautiful glimpses of this universal love. It helps us also maybe be better people in all of our other relationships. Every day, for nearly 25 years now, I have chosen to reaffirm the vow I made to Amy because that vow is the best thing that's ever happened to me. So what helps us stay in a marriage that isn't a wasteland or evil? There's no magic answer. You can analyze marriages and pick them apart and try to see why does this one work, and it's really hard to know. But I do think there's some strategies that give us a higher probability of success, and I'm going to share today my top 7 strategies. And I want to observe quickly that most of these can be tweaked just slightly and work for every kind of relationship, not just marriage. Okay, so the first and by far the most important to me is a strategy which is counterintuitive, and it is to develop your own self. As family systems theory has shown, a key to a strong, flexible relationship is for both parties, in the lingo of family systems theory, to be self-differentiated. When we are self-differentiated, that means there is a completeness and an autonomy to us. We don't need completion from another to be a whole person. We see our own happiness as our responsibility, not our partner's. A self-differentiated person has good boundaries, a strong inner direction, and is better able to operate out of his or her own principles rather than being simply reactive. A self-differentiated person is less concerned about what others, including the partner, think, and is not guided overly by a need for love and acceptance. And relationships just seem to work better when there's a higher degree of self-differentiation. Without the neediness and the reactivity, a couple is more flexible and adaptable. Self-differentiation makes true mutuality, true equality, and togetherness possible. So the interesting thing about self-differentiation is a strategy that is, if a marriage is not in good shape, it actually only takes one person to begin to change it. Working on developing yourself, the only person you can control at all, actually can change your relationship. This is why when someone comes in to talk to me who's just so completely discouraged because their marriage is on the rocks and their partner refuses to get counseling, I say, go get counseling yourself. Becoming more self-differentiated is not easy, but it actually can change the relationship. It's probably the only way, in fact, that the relationship can change. Even if we're the least little bit successful in this endeavor, it can flip things, change things. So it turns out that the number one strategy, I think, for making a marriage work better is actually a solitary project. And here let me plug a great tool for this, which is spiritual practice, meditation, prayer, journaling, and so many other practices are just terrific ways to develop yourself, your self-understanding, self-affirmation. So you want to improve your marriage? Try meditating by yourself. It might actually help. Second on my list of strategies is intimacy. And I'm speaking here of the broad category of intimacy, including sexual intimacy. And a little warning here, you're going to hear some things in the next few minutes that aren't normally spoken from pulpits in America. So true intimacy only happens, I think, when couples are self-differentiated. Intimacy, in other words, works best when we figuratively and literally touch our partner from the best of ourselves and not from our needy and insecure selves. And when it comes to sex, this creates the possibility of profoundly meaningful sex, the self-differentiation, far more than our age or the relative beauty of our bodies as judged by this unattainable societal standard. So hear me on this. Self-differentiation is more important than having a young and beautiful body when it comes to profoundly meaningful sex. Intimate relationships are, to use Martin Buber's I-thou phrase, classic I-thou relationships. In an I-it relationship, there is a sense that the other with whom we're related is an object. In an I-thou relationship, on the other hand, we recognize the other as a whole and complete person with inherent dignity and worth. I-thou relationships between two people paradoxically reflect that they are two separate whole people and that there is something very deep that connects them. This, to me, is true interdependence. That deep connection is best experienced in this broad category of intimacy. In his book, Passionate Marriage, Keeping Love and Intimacy Alive in Committed Relationships, David Snarch shares an amazing, yet utterly simple tip for making sexual intimacy with a partner more of the I-thou variety. When you're making love, he suggests, open your eyes. Literally. Look at your partner. Look at yourself. Observe that you are two separate beings. Then notice the connection. It's a miraculous thing. You're not just making love with anybody. You're making love with this person you've committed your life to. This person with whom you've been through some of the sweetest and hardest things in life. Celebrate that you are so deeply connected with this exact person. When it embodies this kind of I-thou relationship, sexual intimacy is one of the most profound spiritual experiences available to a human being. Love isn't blind, the author writes, unless you insist on it. Open your eyes. And as I think about these first two strategies, developing your own sense of self and deepening intimacy, I'm struck that our heart-to-heart couples retreat beautifully addresses both. The retreat gives space for people to be by themselves, to write about deep things going on within themselves, solitary. And then it gives space to share some of those deep truths with each other in the partnership in a safe place. It's a great way, I think, to practice these two strategies. My third strategy is the thing I seem to mention every time when I talk about spiritual practice, no matter what it is, and that is three parts. Pay attention. Consider. Act with intention. In broken down marriages, there's a lot of emotional reactivity. Typically, neither person is truly being who they want to be in the relationship. Changing a bad pattern involves, first of all, noticing it, paying attention. Then it involves thinking about it, analyzing it to see what's going on and if there might be a better way for things to go. It's important in this part to honor and notice our emotions, but at the same time, we need to keep the neocortex in charge and not our reptilian brain, right? And then it's important to act based on what we figured out. In troubled marriages, anxiety gets passed back and forth like a hot potato. Paying attention, considering, acting intentionally is a way to stop that game of hot potato. And as was the case with self-differentiation, a great tool for this is spiritual practice. When I'm faithful to my spiritual practice, my ability to pay attention, think things through, and then act intentionally in relationship just goes up enormously. Okay, got a few more to go, so I'm going to pick up the pace here. The next one is understanding your family of origin. This is another insight of family systems theory. The way we behave in relationships reflects things like the role modeling of our parents, for good or ill, the birth order that we're in our family, and the role that we played in our family of origin. In my wife's and my marriage, for example, we're both the youngest of five children. Well, that's a tricky combination, as it turns out, largely because the youngest in families tend to look to other people for leadership and responsibility. When both partners are looking elsewhere for somebody to be responsible and leader, there's sometimes problems. We don't make decisions very well sometimes. That's a helpful insight for us. And there's nothing from our family of origins that absolutely and for all times prescribes how we're going to be in relationships. We're not doomed to be hopelessly stuck in the same bad patterns as our families of origin. But you have to try to understand those dynamics, and then it may be easier to change how you are in your current relationship. My next strategy is to acknowledge and to honor that every real, as opposed to fairy tale, marriage has a fair amount of discord and incompatibility. Someone gave me an article 10 years ago that I saved because it was really reassuring. Here's what it said. It said, studies of relationships overwhelmingly show that most couples, whether they're happy or unhappy, have a similar number of irreconcilable differences. What is more, all couples, happy or not, tend to argue about the same thing. The article goes on to list those. Top of the list, whether you're rich or poor, is money. Other common topics include household chores, work obligations, kids and differing priorities, golf or family outing, vacation with the kids or without them. That is so reassuring to hear. Those are the same things we argue about over and over again. One study showed that nearly 70% of disagreements in a marriage are never resolved. 70%. So maybe rather than spending all of our time trying to resolve the unresolvable, instead we learn how to handle these disagreements in ways that lower our anxiety, in ways that help us be together in a happier way. Maybe we learn how to live with these incompatibilities. My next strategy closely follows the last. It is to cultivate the related traits of patience, forbearance, and persistence. Change and growth in a marriage, man, that's slow, it's fitful, it's one step forward, one back, a little baby step forward. If you're in a marriage, you got to know it's for the long haul. Nothing's going to happen quickly. And finally, number 7 on my list is a sense of humor. Given everything I've talked about, it's really important to be able to laugh at yourself, to laugh at your partner, to laugh at your relationship together. These things can help you weather a lot of storms. Couples who laugh together seem to grow together and seem to stay together. So for me, marriage is so worth the considerable amount of decades of heart and soul and work. And when it's all said and done, decades hence, I hope, I want to feel my heart quake when I look over and see a grandmother, or maybe even a great-grandmother by then, my life partner, my old friend, in the morning light, beautiful in her blue robe.